This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, I'm Matthew Wade. On tonight's edition of The Informer, we'll be taking a look at racism in the gay community. Last week, The Age highlighted the issue when a young Aboriginal man posted screenshots of the racist abuse he'd faced on gay dating apps, and I spoke to a number of culturally and linguistically diverse men earlier this year about racism for a feature in the Star Observer. On tonight's show, my co-host Ben Grubb and I will chat with two young queer men, Aziz Abubakar and Muhammad Taha, and you'll hear about their experiences with racism in the gay community. On tonight's edition of The Informer, we're taking a look at the issue of racism in the gay community. And right now we're joined by a young man I spoke with at length about the issue earlier this year, Aziz Abubakar. Thank you for joining us, Aziz.
You're welcome.
I guess I thought I'd start by asking a question with a fairly obvious answer. Is racism an issue in the gay community?
It definitely is, 100%.
Definitely is 100%. Short answer, yes, definitely. I guess, in what ways have you experienced it, particularly within that community?
Definitely in many ways. The most prevalent of all is on gay dating apps, mm-hmm. such as the infamous Grindr, also on Tinder and what have you. I first joined, signed up to Grindr when I was 16, even though the minimum age is 18, but we all lie about that.
Scandal.
I remember getting a lot of messages, and I was very new to, gay culture. I wasn't out yet. A lot of questions like, hung? Is it true what they say about black guys? Things like that. Mm. And I think I was very much naive back then. I was sending, dick pics away and all this sort of stuff. Not really knowing that I was, adding to the problem.
But I guess being 16, even now, but experiencing that kind of, those stereotypes on Grindr at a young age, how did that make you feel at the time, people, especially at such a young age?
Yeah. Well, back then it didn't affect me as much as it does now, because I think I was reveling in the popularity that I was getting. I was young, I was a twink, so all these people that were messaging me and stuff, it was validating, and so I sort of pushed aside the uncomfortable sort of messages that I was getting, and just being people like me, people want to sleep with me, want to talk to me, and whatever. Mm-hmm. But definitely when I broke out of that sort of 16 to 18 age bracket and got into my 20s, that's when I sort of saw the dark side of it, and people. Saying that, I wasn't really black because, my dick wasn't over 8 inches, or really hurtful comments like that, which really made me think wow.
And I guess now, yeah, exactly. Now that you recognize, saying it's hurtful, experiencing that kind of thing, how do you approach that? If someone says something to you on one of those apps, do you just ignore it, or have you ever kind of confronted somebody?
A lot of the time I'm I never got time for that, I'm not going to reply. But sometimes I'm no, I'm going to make a point of this, and I'll reply to the message. But I remember a message that I got not long ago, actually today. of some smart aleck that was... So on my profile now, I'm just don't ask me if I'm hung. It's literally on my tagline, mm-hmm. So this smart ass is being it's are you hung? And all this stuff, so I replied to him, and I'm like, first of all, not only black people can have, mm-hmm. large penises, it's not just something that's exclusive to black people. Second of all, I was like, I don't need to answer that. It's a very private question. Mm-hmm. I don't know you. It's start by saying hi, how are you? Mm-hmm. Be a civilized human being rather than, messaging me with one word with no context whatsoever. and just treating me like a piece of meat. Like, what? Like,
well, that's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, you know, when you experience those kind of, I mean, those comments, I mean, how is that? I mean, how are these people perceiving you? Like, you know, it's not really treating you, I guess, in the way, it's not actually having any kind of genuine discussion with you. It's straight away, I guess, putting you in a box, I imagine. So, I mean, why do you think people do that? Do you think they're aware that that's how, that it's casual racism or overt racism in many cases?
No, I think some people do, and, you know, people are just, some people are just bad. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't, like, they obviously know what they're doing is wrong. But I feel with other people, it's just ignorance. And also, in Melbourne, I feel like the white gays, the gaytriarchy, as I refer to them, have a firm hold on everything and every gay establishment there is in Melbourne, especially in Melbourne and Sydney. Mm-hmm. You know, places like The Peel and Puff Doof and The Lead and Circuit, you know, very famous establishments in Melbourne. And all of their advertisements, you know, all of their promotions are all white topless guys with abs and, you know, eyebrows on fleek and whatever. But yeah, like, I've never seen an Asian. I've never seen even a light-skinned black person, like, let alone, you know, a beautiful chocolate man, which was very disturbing to me. You know, like, I literally searched. I went to all these clubs and I was like, let me find just one poster, you know, one guy in the background, you know, but nothing. They're all white.
And what do you think that says, you know, to people in the gay community? Like, does it kind of put, it does it almost create, you mentioned gaytriarchy, does it create this kind of hierarchy of, you know, what is seen as a beauty ideal or standard, you know, in that community, or what's seen as desirable?
Yeah, it's certainly, certainly reinforces that notion, but also it for people like myself that are a minority within a minority, you know, being a person of color and queer, seeing these sort of images all the time, you know, you're always exposed to them, is telling you that you're not good enough. You know, this is the standard. You do not fit into this. You don't fit this label, you know.
Well, that intersectional discrimination I was curious about as well. I guess, you know, you mentioned, you know, you, because of your race and your sexuality, you face double discrimination to an extent. You know, some gay men who might argue, like, some gay men might say, you know, oh, but I understand because I'm gay that, you know, I share your experience. What, how do you respond to that?
Look up something called intersectionality, Oxford Dictionary. Intersectionality is so important. Like, I will not, I can never stress this enough, intersectionality, you know, to the power of infinity, like, please. Yeah, being, just because you're queer does not mean you understand the struggle of every minority, that's every persecuted minority. You can be queer, black, a woman, disabled at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive. And each, you know, each minority that you fit into, you're gonna face certain struggles that you wouldn't otherwise face. So definitely, if you're white, a man, but just happen to be queer, yes, you're going to face, you're obviously going to face some discrimination in your life, but you don't understand the struggle of someone who is a person of color and queer. You can never.
I mean, of course, but when you actually speak to people, like, for instance, on Grindr or even in, even at a club, anywhere, you know, when you, if you confront someone, you know, if someone said something racist or has done something, you know, that is even casually racist and you've called them up on it, how do people typically respond? Like, for instance, you know, today when you said someone just wrote hung question mark and you kind of responded with, well, you know, that's like, why are you asking that kind of thing? What would people's response generally be? Do they kind of feel, do they feel uncomfortable, or do they usually, how do they respond?
Well, can I use profanity? No, the guy that I messaged today, he said, I give no F's. Like,
yep.
Like, that was literally his reply. Like, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he didn't care at all. He just saw it as this big joke.
And where do you think that lack of understanding or awareness comes from? You know, the fact that, you know, you've called him up on something that is obviously wrong and he's just laughing it off. To him, it's not a big deal.
Well, it's because it's not a big deal, like, for a lot of people. It's people rarely talk about it. You know, I think that you know, white gay males, you know, the members of the gaytriarchy should actually step up and use that platform they have in the gay community to speak about these issues more. Not just, you know, when it's, you know, like, some week, you know, some special occasion, or if it's midsummer or something, like, it should be talked about all the time, so everyone's aware.
I actually love that that term, the white gatriarchy. I don't love what it represents and how it exists in society, but I love that. I guess how does it permeate our society? You know, in Melbourne, how do I say this? You know, the white gatriarchy, like, what is their place in Melbourne? Like, how do you see that manifest? You know, that idea of, like, there being some sort of racial hierarchy in the gay community.
It's definitely this overwhelming sense of privilege that they have. When I rarely, but sometimes I go to Poof Doof. I'm not proud of it. I despise that place.
I'm
but
not anyway, the high cover charge. Jesus.
Yeah. Oh my God. And it's like, a birthday list $15. Okay. What a discount. Anyway, so when I go there, definitely majority white gay men, beautiful bodies, you know, I won't take that away from them. But when we're talking about substance and, you know, how they treat, you know, other queers, especially, queer people of color, it's disgraceful. Like, the things I see there, you know, I go there usually very drunk. That's how I end up there. But, I'll be dancing, and then all these guys will come up, like, I'll be on the podium or whatever.
As in white gay men?
White gay men, yeah. And they'll, you know, I'll be dancing and they'll come and ruffle my hair or, like, slap my ass. Like, without, like, it's like, I didn't come to you. We weren't dancing together. There was no initiation of, like, intimacy or, like, it's not like I was dancing with you and, like, we're going to get it on. Like, I'm on my own dancing with my friends and they just come and, you know, slap the butt or, like, grab me or something. And it just makes me feel so uncomfortable. And yeah, it's why I rarely go there, and because I just it's so comfortable.
I mean that's awful. But I guess where do you think that sense of, particularly with, like, running someone's hands through your hair? I mean, I've seen, like, you know, at clubs, obviously people might grab other people without consent, which is bad to begin with. But, you know, something like, you know, running someone's their hands through your hair, like, where do you think that sense of entitlement comes from?
I don't know. It could come from many places. I think the way that you know, gay men are portrayed in the media plays a large role in that. Black, especially in shows that feature queer characters, I always see people of color being, you know, secondary characters, to be like the sidekick or, like, you know, like the sassy black friend or, like, you know, something like that. There's what's this show called? How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah.
There's one of the major characters is a gay man, and his boyfriend is this Asian guy. Mm-hmm. And the Asian guy is, like, so subservient. Like, every time, like, the, you know, the white guy says, like, you know, do this or, like, don't do that. And it's like, okay, like, just listens to him. And they always have the, like, on the show, they always fight. And the white guy is always the dominant one, you know? Like, the person of color, all the relationships that I've seen on screen, the person of color is subservient or is, like, the bottom. Or
so do you think that the media have a role to play here in getting rid of this casual racism? I mean, there's Benjamin Law's The Family Law. He's a gay man and and an Asian.
Yes.
And so do you think that, yeah, the media has a role here to play?
Definitely. I think that the more queer and specifically gay role models, gay people of color that are in the media, definitely there will be a paradigm shift, and we will see it almost instantly, you know, because we're always on Facebook, we're always on YouTube, we're, you know, always consuming, you know, so we'll definitely pick up on it. And people, especially the younger generation, you know, the future twinks and bears and otters of tomorrow, they will definitely pick up on it and they will see it. And once they see that, you know, oh, it's okay to be, you know, black and gay. It's okay to be an Asian, you know, an Asian gay guy or whatever. And, like, it's cool. And, like, we don't have to aspire to be, you know, like, lighter skinned or, you know, have straighter hair or, like, look a certain way. When that happens, obviously the racism will not be extinguished forever, though we hope and pray. but it can definitely be reduced by a lot.
Definitely. That was Aziz Abubakar. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Informer, and if you want to have your say, send an email to onair@joy.org.au or text the studio on 0427-JOY-949. Up next, we'll be joined by another young man, Muhammad Taha, who will chat with us about his take on racism in the gay community. You're listening to The Informer, and right now we're joined by Muhammad Taha, who has experienced racism in the gay community and has also experienced feeling like, I guess, a token friend of colour among primarily white friendship circles. Thank you for joining us, Muhammad. I recall you talking a while ago about being viewed, I guess, as a token or a cultural asset in the past. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, thank you for having me. It's more, you know, it's like kind of the dehumanisation of a person and reducing you to kind of a portrait that, for instance, a white friend would have at their home. So you're like, you know, you're nice to look at and ponder on how you came to be as a queer person of colour, but in reality, you are still viewed as this, like, you know, outsider, like this new form of existence that's in their life, if that makes sense.
No, of course. I guess have there been specific experiences where you've gone somewhere, I guess, with a group of white friends or something, and you felt that? Like, can you describe one of the experiences?
Actually, that's in that regard. You know, whenever, like, I was recently at a friend's birthday, and then I realized that I was the only person of color in the hall. Like in the whole venue, like in the whole like room, and once I pointed that out to, I was just like having a conversation. It wasn't even like I wasn't even like trying to make a point. I was just saying that, you know, like, do you ever wonder why I am the only person here? And they were like, oh, surely this person is not racist. And I was like, that's like your word, not mine. And then like when we arrived to that in that conversation, realized that there's a big difference between my friendship to this friend and their friendship to this friend. So yeah, their friendship is more of a like kind of a brotherhood and that kind of arrangement, where I was that kind of stranger from another land with whom they like ran to a uni, and then that friendship flourished and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious, you know, I spoke about it with Aziz earlier, but like, you know, in those instances when you actually bring that up, you know, and you actually mention, you know, you bring up that difference, you know, you call someone out on that, I guess, how are these people responding? Like, were they aware of this, or did they accept what you were saying?
The first reaction is, as I said, they go, oh, surely that's not due to racism, because like, you find that a lot of white people have, like, they're sensitive to that issue because of history and that kind of stuff. So when you bring that up, they really, it makes them quite uncomfortable. And I understand that it makes them uncomfortable, but I'd be like, your discomfort in this, like, 30-second, like, kind of interaction does not come anywhere near my life experience as a person who's in the receiving end of that prejudice. So it just fascinates me how someone can like overreact, and then like they kind of shy away from the conversation because, one, they don't want to acknowledge it, because if they do, they have to arrive at a conclusion that someone dear to them is actually a little bit racist and that kind of stuff.
And that's the thing, you know, I imagine a lot of people aren't even aware, like, you know, I probably am referring more specifically to white gay men, that, you know, racism even is an issue in the gay community specifically. So, you know, and you just mentioned it. I mean, you know, it gives a lot of people, I imagine, a sense of uncomfortability to be, you know, exposed to that idea. How do you think, I guess, we could make it more apparent or highlight the fact that it is an issue in the gay community? In what ways could we kind of begin to tackle that?
I think the first thing to do is to kind of introduce, it's a visibility problem, because all these I know this is like a generalization, and I try and avoid them as much as I can. However, most of these, like, you know, gay boys who live in those kind of environments, that's all they see. They have been introduced on television, they have been introduced in the media, in everything. Like, you know, the white picket fence can only happen with another blonde white boy with whom your family agrees. And, you know, that kind of vision of that traditional family, where even in a search community, that like that struggle against the embracing people of color is still ongoing, and most of these issues are kind of brushed under the rug and that kind of stuff. But I think the main thing is visibility, because they need to know that there is such thing as like beauty in people of color. There is such thing as like a very rich culture. Like as in, like for instance, I came to someone's house and their mother introduced me to wine, and I was like, okay, like, do you understand that? Like you know, like she was speaking to me like I'm this person.
Did you say wine as in the drink?
Yeah. She was like, oh, this beverage is delicious, and I'm like, I had to walk away from that interaction because there's absolutely no kind words that I can.
That's
like,
ridiculous.
Share. You'd be amazed. That was just, no, but like I said, like in her worldview, that is a perfectly okay thing to say to a stranger, because you make a set of assumptions.
Mm.
And as I said, like anything I say is going to sound like an overreaction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, well, then, yeah.
Because I have been in a situation when I call people out, and then people look at you like you're this crazy person in the room who's imagining things. for example, if I put my name on a resume, and even though I'm more qualified than a lot of my peers, and then someone else puts their name, whether it's Jonathan or like Oliver or something like that, Oliver would be like, we're more likely to hear, like, to get a phone call, like, than me. And that's a fact. And the fact that people still, like, don't acknowledge that, I think it's a fact, like, worth checking. Like, you know, if people, like I said, like, it's more, I believe that equality is more of a, like, a white journey, as in, like, because people of color, this to them, this is their, like, birthright. It's not, like, equality is not, like, something that, like, it's not an extra thing. I'm not going to take equality and say thank you. I'm going to take equality and say this is my birthright. If that makes sense?
No, definitely. And we've actually just got a text message through the Joy text message service from David, who said, when we don't consciously include, we unconsciously exclude, which, I mean, it's probably tying into what you're saying, Muhammad, about the fact that people don't, I mean, they're uncomfortable, but they don't even, they've never actually thought about it before. They've never been exposed. They don't even realize that it even is an issue until someone actually calls them out on it. I guess, do you think that it's just a fact, you know, particularly these, gay white men, for instance, you know, they tend, like, you know, these circles of friends that are predominantly white, you know, do you think that it's a coincidence that they all just happen to spend time with people that look exactly like them?
Oh, no, certainly not. Like, I understand, like, you know, from, like, an evolutionary perspective, so, like, I do science, so, like, I have to kind of kick in some science. From, like, an evolutionary perspective, it's okay to, like, kind of, you're more likely to be with your kin in that kind of regard. Yeah. However, like, in a social construct, in a multicultural society, that's no longer, like, a good argument.
Of course.
So the fact that you reach your, like, say, mid-20s or 30s and you do not have a single, like, friend who's not white, that is certainly an indicative of the people that you choose to surround yourself with, because our values do not belong to a certain race.
Like, sorry, Muhammad, I might have to cut you off there. We're just running out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Have a lovely night.
Hi, this is Ruby, and I'm joined today by Noah Michelson, the editorial director of Voices at the Huffington Post and executive director of Queer Voices, who's based in New York. Thank you so much for being here with us on The Informer, Noah.
Thanks for having me, Ruby. How are you?
I'm very well. So I thought today we could talk about the on-trend transphobia that really seems to be escalating in Northern Carolina after the passing of House Bill 2, or HB 2. Just for our listeners, House Bill 2 has been one of the most sweeping breaches in discrimination protection for LGBT people that's been seen, and has been causing quite a lot of conversation around the country. So can we talk about what's been going down there since we last spoke on it, Noah?
Yeah, it's really getting more and more intense kind of every single day on both sides. You know, you have the governor who's digging his heels in even more. And he's saying that the response to HB2 has been this sort of beautifully orchestrated campaign by the HRC, which is the Human Rights Campaign. And he's basically saying that they are just trying to get him out of office, and that the whole reason that people are making a big stink about this is because they want him out of office. Of course, that's not true. We both know that the Democrats and the HRC are only responding to the fact that they passed this law, which is quite possibly the most anti-queer law that's ever been passed in the country. So you have that going on the governor's side. On the other side, you've got more and more people speaking out. There have been a bunch of arrests that happened. There were people who were protesting in the state capitol. I think, 30 or 40 people got arrested.
The numbers I have say 54 people, including Mara Kingsling, who's the executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality.
And it's really interesting because Mara, earlier in the day, she actually used the restroom in the governor's office.
Yeah, I saw her photograph.
They can't, they can't even enforce the law that they passed. Here's a trans woman in the governor's office using his restroom. And she said, I went in, I did my business, and I left. And that's what trans people all across the country want to do. All they want to do is pee and then leave. It just sort of pointed out the absurdity of what's going on in that state right now.
No, I can understand. I think as well people are pointing out that, if trans people are expected to bring in their birth certificates every time they use a bathroom, will that be enforced with other people? Are we going to, is it because everyone should have to? That's how laws in the United States work, that everyone is, has to deal with them. So if you're asking then people to show some kind of identification, either through their genitals or through their birth certificate, you're going to have to start either expecting every single person who works in a state building to bring in their birth certificate or to make some kind of a patch. And I have to admit, I do think one of the problems I've really seen from this is that there's been this kind of people backing violence, people, trying to concentrate on that. It's about stopping predators. It's not just about trans people. It's about, making sure that our children are safe in these bathrooms. And a lot of those people do seem to be able to directly just straight out advocate for violence and, say things like, if they see a man in a bathroom with their baby daughter, they're going to kill him, no matter what he feels.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, the fact that we've reached a point where you can advocate for violence and death, I think is an extremely worrying state of affairs. Now, on a slightly lighter note, James Franco and his sexuality. Now, so one of the quotes I quite liked was, if you define gay and straight by who I sleep with, I guess you can say I'm a gay cock tease. Would you like to help me unpack this a bit, Noah? Is he speaking about being gay in art and straight in life? And if so, does he think sex is the only part of what makes someone homosexual? I'm a bit confused.
It is very confusing, and I think that's exactly what he wants us to be. I think he's being very coy about both his professional life and his personal life, but I think that what we can take from it, I can't tell you if James Franco is gay or a little bit gay or bisexual or straight. What I can tell you, though, is that he's making some interesting distinctions that we can all sort of think about our own lives and the way that we think about sexuality, and it brings up a good point. What does it mean to be gay? Does that mean that you have to sleep with someone of the same sex? Or what if you're just gay culturally? One of the things that I really like about James Franco is that he probably knows more about queer history and about queer culture than a lot of queer people do. I mean, he's taken classes about it. He's written about it. He's done movies about it. He's very much invested in our culture and in our history. And I think that's really important, especially at a time now when I see so many younger queer people who don't know anything about our culture and don't know anything about our history. And so I'm not sure that I really need James Franco to be having sex with men, which maybe he is doing anyways, but I think I can welcome him into our community and say that he's doing good things and he's raising interesting questions. And at the very least, he's making me think about what it means to be queer.
I'll have to leave it there. Thank you again so much for joining us here on The Informer.
Yeah, I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you to my guests today, Aziz Abubakar and Mohammed Taha. Today's head producer was Ben Grubb and myself, with assistance from Bart Vanderwerf. For a podcast of today's program and our other stories, visit joy.org.au/theinformer. The Informer will be back on Monday evening at 6:30. Up next is Stand Up Straight. I'm Matthew Wade.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.